that case, Bruno Parentani, who's sitting over there, not yet, but my still in the rest, he's writing transparent, so you better prepare. But first we have Jens, his viewpoint.
Okay, so when I told Achim and Justin that I had nothing substantially new to talk about, they said, oh, that's okay. Just go ahead and ask some questions and make some speculative proposals and just go ahead and look forward, like Achim said. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. So I'm going to ask questions, which I'm sure you will be able to answer. Those are not rhetorical questions. These are just questions that I'd like to have answered. And towards the end, I'll make a very wild proposal for mode creation, which you will be able to kill on the spot. So I hope that this talk will be beneficial at least to one person, and that's me. So let's start by pointing out where I'm starting from and where I'm trying to be going. This will be a much more pedestrian talk than many of the ones we heard yesterday, in the sense that I'm not going to talk about quantum gravity at all. So the setting will be purely semi-classical. I'll try to see how far we can go. By high K vacuum, in particular, I mean transplanckian, or at least very high frequencies that may be affected by gravitational physics. The motivation is very pragmatic. The question that I'd like to ask is, what are good constraints on the choice of the vacuum at high wave numbers? Yes? I'm sure it's on. Yes? You have trouble hearing me?
No.
It's on. Let's switch. Really, this is a very down-to-earth question, because there's a number of principles that have been used to constrain the choice of this initial vacuum. And I'd just like to mention a few that you run across in the literature and put them out for debate, see which of those you consider to be more fundamental and which may simply be an artifact of our ignorance. Okay? Eventually, of course, I think we'd be happier if we had some dynamics to produce or to predict the initial state. But this may involve knowing more about quantum gravity, which, as I said, I'm not going to talk about. It may not, then. So this again, is a question that I'd like to pose. There is a very direct reason for this. It has observational relevance. There may be signatures of the vacuum at very high wave numbers in the CMBR, in the microwave background. And I'm not going to talk about this because I hope that Jérôme will enlighten us with all the latest constraints on CMB physics and signatures. There's also a second potential signature which has not been talked about that much, and that is particle production. Now, due to non-standard, non-vacuum physics at very high wave numbers. And there are controversial point of views on how strongly constrained the vacuum is from the point of view of particle production. So Starobinsky and Kraček claim that this already strongly constrains the signature of the difference of the vacuum with the choice of the vacuum. Whereas there are other people who say that this might not be as strong a constraint as these authors claim. So I think this is a field that is worthwhile revisiting, and it may place some real constraints. Now, the standard vacuum for the de Sitter space time is the Bunch Davis vacuum, which is the de Sitter invariant adiabatic vacuum. And the question is, can small deviations from this? So we know that deviations cannot be large. Otherwise, you would already see strong differences in particularly in these two fields. But how much is still allowed? Can small deviations, in fact, be observable? And I think this is a really interesting question, because it might give us a direct handle on high wave number physics and be able to constrain them based on observations. Now, let me just mention one example where few people would have expected a small deviation from the standard result, and that's the cosmological constant. Everybody had expected cosmological constant to be zero based on a number of principles. And it turned out to be just slightly off of zero. So, you know, perhaps we're extremely lucky and we can find a similar effect here in the high wave number vacuum. Okay, so the first question is, you know, perhaps purely semantic, and that is, are these high wave number modes continuously created, or do they exist in some sense? And what I mean by existence here is simply, technically, should they be prescribed as an initial condition on some space-like hypersurface at some initial time, as is done in the standard formulation of effective field theory, and I think Conrad will probably talk a little bit about this, or is it useful to prescribe them on some surface of new physics, it's not really a hypersurface, at their Planck scale crossing. So whenever a new mode enters its Planck scale, we prescribe an initial condition. So this is very similar to what Renaud talked about yesterday, but without necessarily breaking Lorentz invariance or any additionally new physics, but simply a different way of prescribing boundary problems. So turn an initial value problem into a sort of a boundary value problem. It's purely a mathematical question. Does it even give rise to any differences in this region here, which is accessible to observation? So I took this plot from a paper by Richard Isserel. You can see what it means. Here's some physical length scale lambda as a function of time or of the scale factor. And, this is an initial space-like hypersurface. The problem with prescribing initial conditions is, of course, that you have to prescribe them down to infinitesimally small length scales, so up to infinitely high wave numbers. The problem with the new physics hypersurface, as they call it, is that it's not the standard formulation of partial differential equations. It's a very strange way of describing boundary conditions. Okay, so there's an analogy that I'd like to offer, and that is, imagine we didn't know about inflation, but we observe the acoustic peaks in the CMBR, then of course we can simply prescribe initial conditions for cosmological perturbations, but then we have to do this at some initial time, including super horizon scales, which is acausal and not very satisfactory. Or alternatively, we can prescribe boundary conditions for the modes as they enter the Hubble horizon, in the correct phase, so only with the growing mode present. Both of those proposals, now from our point of view, are incomplete. And fortunately, we do have a dynamical process like inflation that solves this problem in a more satisfactory manner. And that's what's lacking in the Trans-Planckian case. Okay, so the question is, which is better at the moment? Where do we have to look for more useful answers? Okay, let's take a slightly philosophical detour, and that is, what does existence mean? Is this a useful question to pose at all? If it doesn't make any difference for observations, is it just a purely technical question? And in particular, as you know, orthodox reductionists, we should try to reduce the amount of unobservable information in our theories, and the vacuum at Trans-Planckian frequencies is not directly observable. Direct probes of these length scales give rise to strong curvature and black hole formation, which is called by getting some co-workers to locality them. And there's very many indications that you cannot probe length scales smaller than the one scale. And infrared effects in expanding spacetimes, for instance, do not constrain whether the initial conditions are prescribed on some space-like hypersurface or whether they're created. So I think this is perhaps philosophical, but I think also an interesting technical question. Does it make any difference? Why do we actually care? Is this a useful question? Do we actually have to talk about wall creation? Or is this purely semantics? Yes?
What do you do in your mind about this point if you try to probe it and then you get involved with black hole formation? And so what does the question mean? What do you mean by mode then? What is the definition?
Well, I think that's exactly the question. What do I mean? What is the meaning of a notion which has no direct relevance for any conceivable
object? Not direct relevance, but the very construction in one's mind.
You could imagine probing space when the distance is smaller than one, with particles, for instance. But then as soon as these particles form their own horizon, you don't get the information. So it is conceivable to me.
What I always have in mind is it meaningful to ask, if I look into a liquid and I ask what the momentum of a molecule is, when I know in the liquid they're strongly interacting and they hit their neighbors, it just as often as they oscillate due to their energy having momentum, it is a meaningful question even to talk about a momentum over the molecule in the liquid.
But yes,
and so at the Planckian scale, is it meaningful to talk about modes given that they're strongly at this scale, given that they're strongly interacting with the whole medium? How am I to conceive of it as a mode even? Isn't it just a mess?
I'm taking the purely pragmatic point of view from the low energy side.
Yes.
So how much?
I'm just pushing.
You're pushing, but you already have a very concrete model in your mind for an extension towards small distances. Okay. So I'd like to be ignorant about this as much as I can, and then say, does it make more sense to prescribe initial conditions on a
spectrum? So you just push to see how far you
get. How far can you get? And do we run into paradoxes trying to do this? And at this point, I don't see an obvious paradox in either of the approaches. And so, let's move on and ask what kinds of criteria people choose when they argue for some vacuum. And again, this is nothing new. This is stuff that has been in the literature for decades.
But just to mention that you do not even, in ordinary particle physics, it's a question of resolution. Resolution is given by the virtual particles which you exchange with the object you want to probe. And a virtual particle can have arbitrary high momenta, and it does not rely on the definition of a mode. So it need not to be a real particle or a real mode which probes space-time.
Can you make it?
Yeah, like a deep and elastic scattering, you know that. The resolution is given by the exchange of the virtual particle. It has nothing to do with momentum on the real particle.
But if energy is greater than the Planckian energy, won't it bust everything?
Oh, well, you integrate over all possible virtual momenta. And he said he ignores quantum gravity, which must give a wrong answer, but nevertheless, that's our setting of discussion. And then we just integrate out all possible virtual momenta we can get as high as infinity. And these are our probes. It's like a deep and elastic scattering.
I don't buy it, because it's going from a medium with which it's strongly interacting. It's a strongly interacting system. Can you talk about
a proton is a strongly interacting bound state?
Can you talk about the gauge in the non-medium gauge theory? Can you talk about a photon at small momentum?
I can give you an
example. It isn't a thing that you
I mean, journalistic scattering is a perfect analog. You have a strongly interactive bound state, the proton, yeah. And you probe it with a virtual photon. And the resolution is which you probe it.
What I'm saying is that the spectrum does not contain what we can call, in that case, a strong, a long wavelength of photons. Here we're asking, does the spectrum contain short wavelength of gravitons?
I thought he wanted to probe space-time basically on arbitrary small distances. And for that,
he wanted to probe space-time at small distances.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, that this region is inaccessible directly. So, pragmatically speaking, since this is all that's accessible, does it even make a difference?
Another way I can put it is mathematically, if we believe that space-time is grainy, and that the modes propagate on grains, then can you make an entity which investigates what's in the brain?
I agree with that. In his setting, he's not considering quantum gravity. Grainy space-time would be an input of gravity. Not quantum field theory, such as it does not exist. Right.
Okay, but let me perhaps move on. But I'm glad that it has triggered some discussion. Okay, so which principles are there to constrain the vacuum state? And I'm a little bit reluctant to use the word principles because it always reminds me of discussing moral issues, and that's what we're not trying to do here. So let's call them criteria, okay? There's always symmetry, of course. Now, symmetry, perhaps I should say isometry, because I'm talking about space-time symmetry, not about an internal symmetry of the field. In the obvious example is in the case of Cassiter invariants, there's a family of Cassiter invariant vacua for a massive scalar field at least, which are called the alpha vacua, which include the Bunch Davis vacuum, but they contain one complex parameter alpha, which all give rise to Cassiter invariant vacuum. Now, in this case, symmetry is an imprint, or should be an imprint of some initial symmetry. So again, we need some dynamics to explain why our background is symmetric in the first place, and that's exactly what we don't have. There's very few proposals around for predicting the initial symmetry. It's a big debate. I only throw out the term landscape right now, but I don't want to get into this at all. And then, of course, there's the older theories of quantum cosmology. Now, in all of these proposals, symmetry is a large-scale property, and smaller scales are perturbed. Of course, these perturbations are treated perturbatively, so there's some assumption that these perturbations are small, but this is not directly predicted from first principles. So the question that I'd like to pose here is, why would the large scale symmetry, which you may argue for based on some arguments, why should this be inherited by infinitesimally small scales? So going to k equals infinity, why would any very small scale know about the Cassiter invariant? So this may not be a very important point, but now, assuming that observations might become sensitive to a difference between a Cassiter invariant state, exactly the Cassiter invariant state, and just some approximation to the Cassiter invariant state, this is, I think, the question that we need to address. It's observationally relevant. Perhaps the strongest argument comes from decoupling, which is the equivalence principle in disguise, the fact that we know that effective field theory works at low energies, and so we'd like to have the small scales behave like in flat space because we know it works. Okay? Now, is this just an artifact of us creating field theories that work well if the background is asymptotically flat? Or is it really fundamental? Okay. Again, I don't want to answer the question. I'd like you to debate this. Is this really fundamental or not? Technically, we know that in order to get a conservatively normalizable expectation value of the energy momentum tensor, we know that physics must be locally flat, or technically speaking, the vacuum must be adiabatic to fourth order. Now, this is a weaker statement than exact symmetry because it's only an asymptotic state. It does not require exact symmetry out to in infinite wave numbers. But notice that if you combine one and two, you get the Bunch Davis vacuum. But you need both. One of them is not enough. And if you're sensitive, if your observations are sensitive one to one or two, you might be able to tell. That's one. Then there's one framework that claims to predict the Bunch Davis vacuum from a dynamical principle. And that's the quantum cosmology framework using boundary conditions that you might know. One of the popular ones is the Harden-Hawking no boundary proposal for the wave function of the universe. Another one is Vilenkin's tunneling proposal. Interestingly, all of those independently claim to directly predict from first principles the Bunch Davis vacuum of the universe. And this is based on regularity of the wave function of the universe. And I'll go through this argument on the next slide. So let me postpone this a little bit. The question that I'm not really sure about, and again, I ask you for your opinion, is this actually equivalent to point two, to decoupling, to locally flat physics? I have a suspicion it is, but I haven't seen any papers that make this argument.
You mean, are you asking if the tunneling scenario is equivalent?
No, I'm asking is the constraint on the vacuum, on the state of the perturbations in the scenario, which follows from finiteness of the wave function in this case. Is this just an artifact or just a different way of posing the equivalence?
Actually,
after the tunneling of the Harden-Hawking tunneling, the no boundary conditions, what comes out?
That's just ordinary physics.
Is that what you mean by this?
Let me go through their argument, perhaps, and then we can discuss this. But did you have a comment?
I'll wait for your argument, but at least the Halley-Wolff-Hopkins story is equivalent to one. It's just the symmetry.
But symmetry alone, as we saw, does not constrain the vacuum.
Well, it's the symmetry completely plus the Euclidean continuation. The Bunch Davis vacuum is also known as the Euclidean vacuum.
Yes, I know, but then what is the principle? Euclidean continuation is not really a physical principle, if you'd like to.
In that scenario that they have, it's not scenario, it is.
I'd be interested in hearing that. So, there's an all-time favorite here at the end, and that's naturalness. Cynically, you could say this is what you use if everything else fails, but it might be a fundamental argument. In a very sloppy formulation, the deviation from a Bunch Davis vacuum must be small for all of the known reasons, including observations. So without any fine-tuning, the state should be exactly in Bunch Davis vacuum. Now, let me just comment that we have been fooled before. The cosmological constant is not so. So naturalness is, I think, the weakest contender for a good. Next question, does quantum cosmology really predict a Bunch Davis vacuum on transplanting scales, as they claim? What are the assumptions that go into this derivation? And I'll try to give you the argument in a nutshell, but please be aware that I'm not an expert in this, and I just read these papers recently, trying to see if I understood. Here's one reference to where this argument is made. There's a number of other papers, including Hollinger and Hawking. So you start with the wave function for the universe, with the equation for the wave function of the universe, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is Hamiltonian constraint in a quantum setting for the wave function of the universe. And the action that is considered consists of a minimally coupled scalar field, and you throw away everything but the constant term and the potential, so it amounts to a de Sitter space, they focus on closed spaces in this time, in this case, for finiteness. And you consider perturbations on top of this. So your scalar field is allowed to have small perturbations. The scalar field, again, like in usual inflationary physics, is expanded in this case to dependent spherical harmonics. That doesn't really make any difference. And then if you plug this all into the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, you end up with something that looks very much like a familiar quantum mechanics problem, which depends on the scale factor x is logarithm of a, on the amplitudes or the mode functions of the perturbations, and the potential, which has this form, has a V naught, which depends only on lambda and the scale factor. So it's a to the fourth times 1 minus lambda a squared. And then another term, which depends quadratically on the mode amplitudes, the perturbations. So it's a very figurative example of quantum mechanics. The problem separates, so you can write the wave function as a product, and the problem is equivalent to n two-dimensional quantum mechanical problems for each mode. And I try to draw the potential here. So there's a potential barrier produced by lambda, essentially, which has two directions. One is the x direction, which corresponds to the scale factor, and then there's an orthogonal direction y, and I try to depict here the parabolic dependence in y direction of each node. And the solution is, in general, y is the fn. So y is the mode amplitude of the perturbations. In general, there's solution is a superposition of a growing and a decaying component in the under area region, so underneath the potential, as long as the potential is positive, and the combination of left and right moving components in the classically allowed regime. So classically, the universe bounces here at this turning point, but quantum mechanically, it is allowed to tunnel through the barrier. That's the tunnel. So what does this do? You can write, make an ansatz for the wave function of this form, which then the authors expand in H-bar as a semi-classical approximation. And you end up with two equations. One corresponds eventually to the Friedmann equation, which is just the classical evolution of the universe. And one, after some manipulations, ends up being the usual mode equation for what are derivative modes. So there's really nothing new here. Okay? And then, as we all know, we have to choose a vacuum for these modes. So this is a second-order differential equation. Now, how do they do this? They claim that regularity requires that the real part of Sn, here the phase in this ansatz, needs to be positive, otherwise the norm of psi runs away. It's unbounded for large Sn. It turns out that the only component that is relevant for this argument is this growing component here under the barrier. Then the matching conditions require that the state is that the coefficients of the state are equal at the turning point, therefore equal everywhere. So as soon as you have a requirement on the state from one of the components, it automatically applies to all the components. Right? Now, that's what makes it indifferent to which boundary conditions you actually use, because they all contain a growing component underneath the barrier. So the Hartle-Hawking proposal corresponds to only having a growing component. So they set the decaying component to zero in different words. The Vedenkin proposal corresponds to having only a right moving wave function in the classical region. But they both contain this growing.
So if you use the word regularity, how can singularity develop in this case?
They use the word regularity. It's just bounding. Yes, I know. This is what I'm quoting. Okay. It's not singularity. It's really boundedness of this expression for a large fn. And this is one of my questions, is since we make the assumption of Fn being perturbatively small in the first place, why is this a strong argument? Not an important question, but this is the only dynamical proposal that I've seen anywhere that predicts, to some extent, the Bunch-Davis vacuum. So I think it's important to take another look at it now that it potentially becomes observationally relevant.
Yes. I have a stupid question, maybe you can remind me. I mean, I can, of course, test the age acting on the society of Seal, right? But age is time dependent, the Hamiltonian.
Yes.
So
Not in this case.
It
contains time. So one of the variables is A. So A is X in this case, and that is time.
Then it doesn't matter for my argument, because I could do an A-dependent canonical transformation of my scalar to phi.
Yes.
Of course, since the transformation is canonical, it's not supposed to change any observable. But since I define my vacuum state via the relation you gave to us, I might get different answers. That's the problem, is A-dependent or time-dependent Hamiltonians, that you can do A-dependent redefinitions of your canonical variables. And that's, I think, the real problem of defining a vacuum state when you have a time.
You see, this is not really canonical quantization here. This is first quantization, quantum mechanics. I'm not sure if the problem really arises. Quantum mechanical problem.
Okay, so you don't respect quantum mechanics rely on a quantum.
True, and it is in Hamilton.
Then I'm allowed to do canonical transformations.
I'm just not sure if you get a different result. But let's just finish the argument.
I think you do.
So,
I think you do get a different result.
You do get a different answer? Well, I do make an A-dependent transformation here, as usual, in order to get rid of the damping term, of the Hubble damping term.
I think what's often argued is that there's one variable in terms of which actually takes the form of a harmonic oscillator.
Yes.
And that's the variable. It's that for you're supposed to use
But then I need this as an extra principle, and I have to ask, why should this be a principle?
But the results just in this case are equivalent. In those papers, they do not use U. I just put this here to put it into the canonical harmonic oscillator form. They use V and get an identical answer.
I'm happy with your answer. If we use it as an extra principle, I could, of course, ask what is, I mean, is this a really good principle, but...
It's not a principle, it's just that that's, you know how to quantize the harmonical oscillator. So you know...
That's no fundamental argument. That's, for me, I don't say that's not a fundamental
it's
argument.
You know that argument.
It's a pragmatic argument. That's
you,
the case, yeah.
You know what the Grouse statement of harmonic oscillator is.
I need not to be satisfied with this answer. Of course, it's a pragmatic argument, I accept it, but I need not to be satisfied.
They're not quantizing anything. This is a Schrödinger picture. Okay. So
you're talking about a state.
A state. The wave. This psi is a wave
function. Yes, but then.
Which is wrong, and I'm wrong in saying that if you define the vacuum using different variables, you get different results.
Yes.
Or cosmological
conditions. I'm sure.
Many years ago, of course, this was in 1977, but of course, all on Red and I, in the context of the semi-classical, the background, it solved for the modes, and then we required, and we asked if there was a self-consistent solution with a semi-classical back reaction, or whether we could get a TMU mu proportional to TMU mu. That was solving for the modes, something like that, and see what the symmetry of the sum was. And there was such a solution, and that's why we proposed in the flavor as a self-consistently generated because of the creative universe. So And there, in your canonical transformation, you can do as much as you like, but T mu nu proportional. In fact, your expectation guide with T mu nu proportional to T mu nu is what you want.
But that's what Robert says. That's what Robert said. Of course, you always will get that the state you pick out is being destroyed by your Hamiltonian. That's where you start from. But the point is, if I ask what is the wave function of the vacuum state, this is not an invariant answer under canonical transformation. And I think this is one
wave function of the vacuum state, probably in that case. Was encoded in the subtractions.
And maybe it's not observable, so it doesn't matter.
And namely, it was.
Oh, it does matter very much. Because you can learn from it if your quantum fields populate the vacuum in a Gaussian way or not.
No, the vacuum, the state is observable.
It's quantum produces in right
information. All the expectation values are. So the mathematical formula that you write down.
So the norm is observable as well.
As long as they produce the same norm.
I think but it's not complex, it has a real part, so it's not a case that goes away
in the
when you square it.
That's true.
So, and I think that's a very important thing. Fundamentally, we want to find a Brown state. We want to use the Hamiltonian to find a Brown state, but if it's time dependent in a canonical framework, it's very good.
Okay. I'm glad that it produces some debate, but let me just finish the very pedestrian technical argument that I want to make here. So this of course, was very familiar. This is the cosmological damping term here. And now if you focus on the under-barrier growing component, you complexify time, or you rotate time, replaced by IT, and this becomes an hyperbolic cosine, which is so the term becomes maximal at the term turning point. Okay, so this is all we need to worry about if we're interested in the importance of this term. Just look at its maximum, and as you can see there, this becomes one. So this turns into minus two. So for all n larger than one, which in this case is the zero mode, the ground state mode, the homogeneous mode, this term becomes negligible. So intuitively speaking, at the time of the birth of the universe, all of these modes are in an oscillatory regime. They're all sub-horizon. Okay? Whether or not the whole concept of sub- or super-horizon makes sense in this setting, I don't know. But technically, they're all oscillatory. They're not damped. And that's the point of the argument.
How do you calculate the average value of T mu nu once you have the modes?
Well, we don't have them yet. So for now, we still have to solve this equation in terms of the modes. But my point now is that we see already that at all times, or for all n, we can neglect the damping term, and all of the modes are oscillatory, or in the Euclidean sector, they're purely exponential. And this is where the argument comes from. So if you look at the papers, they give a full analytic result for this equation, but that's not necessary for this argument, because you can look at the asymptotics and you just plug in combination of growing and decaying exponential solutions, because as I just argued, this is all that you need, because the damping term is irrelevant. If you plug that in, you get a very simple result for Sn, which is argued to have a positive real part, and as you can see, it is only positive definite for tau going to infinity, which in the Euclidean sector corresponds to A going to zero, if the coefficient, one of the coefficients is zero. You see? Otherwise, this term goes to zero. This becomes minus 2n, so you've got something that becomes negative. That's an extremely simple argument. But it hinges on the fact that all of these modes are purely oscillatory, or in other words, they're adiabatic. So this is why I think this is really equivalent to the good old adiabaticity argument. Okay, now, of course, we've all played these games of modifying transplantian physics and, for instance, make them damped. In this case, this whole argument doesn't work. I haven't done the calculation. Somebody would have to try this and modify this mode equation, for instance, or go more fundamental and modify the action.
just like we tried for standard inflationary perturbations. But my prediction is that since then, the modes will become damped in the Lorentzian sector, they become oscillatory in the Euclidean sector. This argument breaks down. But this is the main argument, okay? You have to set A to zero in order for psi, norm psi, to remain small enough, okay? Now, so this is their claim for a prediction of the Bunch Davis vacuum. Here's all a list of the assumptions that have been made in this derivation, at least the ones that I notice. First of all, of course, the superspace reduction. And the question here is this where we lose the Planck length? Okay. We use diffeomorphism invariance going to mean superspace. So this is where we actually lose Planck scale physics already. Okay. So it has to be put in by hand at any later stage. Then, of course, you assume that Fn is perturbatively small, which kind of invalidates the argument that for large Fn, psi norm blows up. Of course, we're in the semi-classical approximation, and it might be useful in this case to look at high-order corrections. Now, I think this is a very worthwhile field to take another look at, because it's a very controllable setting to relax any of these assumptions. Okay, this is why I mentioned this. I think that perhaps it should be looked at again. And trying to play with it, trying to relax a couple of these assumptions, see where things deviate from this result. And then, as I said, all of the modes here, including the Trans-Planckian modes, are oscillatory in the Lorentzian sector, which may be completely wrong. Okay, so Trans-Planckian corrections may give rise to a completely different vacuum state. So this is really all I wanted to say, because I haven't done any calculations myself. I think it's a fun project to think about. Perhaps somebody will try. So this is the whole point I wanted to make about vacuum state. Now let me entertain you for another 1.5 slides.
So yes. You mentioned previously the subtraction to get the energy regular. Is there anything like a subtraction here when you compute
no.
the action? Why not? Why when? Formally, you said that in order to have regular T milieu, you need to subtract not to go for the spirit of Anderson.
Oh,
yes,
okay.
How you
oh, here, nobody computes T milieu here.
But it's exactly the same, because you feed the matter action into the gravitational sector. This is exactly
well, basically,
the T milieu.
Since you come out with an exactly adiabatic vacuum...
You're happy?
They are happy. I think this is why you don't bother to subtract, because the prediction is exactly adiabatic.
No, but even in the vacuum, you need subtractions.
Yes,
how?
So. So, yes.
And here, without any subtraction?
No, but they're not making any statements about you.
So, but solving the Wiener-Lewis equation, or computing T mu nu and feed it in Einstein's equation is equivalent. So.
Okay. So where has the subtraction gone?
That is your question.
Well, I think there's an arbitrary topological constant in the game that somehow is swept under the rug.
Well, no. It's always there.
No, but the topological constant is due to the models, the infinity.
Okay.
Again on the sum. An additional one to the one you put in.
Okay, but it
should,
ignored. But it's ignored. It should, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It's ignored.
But at which point in the calculation is it ignored?
I don't know. I remember I did
a good question
with Ferry Horowitz in the 1980s or so. We looked under the tunneling region and we wrote the thing as a partition function and we could get a self-consistent temperature because we made photons and then there was 1/8 of 4 and he formed the potential in the region of 8 equal to 0 way in the tunneling under the tunneling potential and then there were oscillations. It was mad, but there were all kinds of complications that you run into when you sum on the boats to get the team you knew and you include the back reactor. And then they escaped, and then what we had is when they escaped, the temperature emerged with the temperature
So this was the evolution of fundamental of the universe.
Okay. You know, it's interesting.
You can do almost anything.
There's a number of papers, recent papers, who sound like they're doing something very similar by the Cornell group and retired co-workers. Perhaps there's some similarity here. Now they're trying to come up with a principle that places the vacuum in the string landscape, but they're using very similar arguments. So I just think that it's a fun thing to read.
Yeah, it's fun.
Anyway, so
I think it might even be a little bit right.
Yeah, well, it's a different game to play, and I think we might learn something.
But what has a string landscape with a cosmological vacuum to do?
No, this is a separate sequence of papers.
Hamlet might be right, so I don't understand what's the connection between the landscape.
If you believe with the tunneling scenario from London potential, and you do dynamics, and you do a partition function, and then you analytically extend to outside, and it can be done, and you did it.
But the landscape vacuum is not.
What emerges is that, and another vacuum, but something which has been heated up, because it has emerged from under a tunneling region, and it could be interpreted as an entropy as a generator due to the tunneling. You can interpret the inner effect, for example. If you have a barrier, and a particle comes in and it tunnels, and you can interpret the heated stuff as entropy that's generated because of experience under the tunneling barrier.
No, and I'm with you in that point. I'm just wondering what that has to do with the string landscape, because the vacuum state safe fine are not, they don't work
on special. Excuse me,
but they don't find the vacuum.
The whole
point
of their selection or their of vacuum states cannot be accountable for any cosmological.
All of this is based on the assumptions that you make from fractions which you can defend, and you can't.
Okay, so let me finish with this highly speculative idea. So it's not even half-baked, it's actually still deep frozen. You say in the steak analogy, it's still happily grazing on the field. So you're now, and you might be able to kill an idea in real time. So what about mode creation by quantum tunneling? As we've seen, the problem decouples for each wave number. So if we now take the liberty of adding a purely ad hoc term in the potential here, and perhaps with some deeper thought, you might be able to place it somewhere in the action. We might, what you need for tunneling is for this potential to become negative, okay, to cross zero. Now, this term has the properties of being much greater than one for n, which is equal to k in this case, much greater than scale factor times the inverse Planck length. So for wave numbers that are still deeply transplanted of the order than one at the Planck scale, crossing at much smaller than one in the accessible low wave number regime. Then this is exactly what happens to the potential. The universe nucleates separately for each wave number. Does this make any sense at all? I don't know, but it's about as good as mode creation with any other manual mechanism that we've thought of so far. It may not be as good as Spinoza's proposal. Yes.
How did you pick the sign? That is F positive or negative, and does it matter?
It doesn't matter because you need it positive for creating a potential barrier.
So is it the conventional sign of matter energy?
No, the opposite sign. This is the problem. Otherwise, you see, I can give you a very simple example, and that's n squared LP squared over a squared, and that's just the radiation component. Unfortunately, it has the wrong sign. Okay.
So you're ready to put a minus sign, a large minus sign contribution to get your effect?
Well, yes, why not? You know, what else breaks up? I mean, what else goes wrong when I do this? At low wave number scales, this term is negligibly small. That's why I said, go ahead and shoot it out of the water. But this is an example how you can do this. No questions. Does it make any sense? So far, it's just a fun game.
Do you have an idea that if you consider the space backwards, that is, if I look at the space like that, then in a normally quantum mechanical problem, what you would do is you would say, A then is a particle, A is the coordinate of the particle, it comes in, it gets reflected from the potential, and then it goes out, and you have the tunneling region. Mm. So in this point of view, you're faced with the existence of the universe prior to the neck, where there is the tunneling that you're looking at. Do you have any ideas about what people do about that?
No. I'm just not sure if it's any different from the usual quantum tunneling problem. In this case, all you do is that you postpone tunneling for each wave number until it crosses its Planck scale. Okay, you tell each wave number, each length scale, to wait tunneling until it's large enough.
So the universe does not begin to exist at the neck. It comes in
at all times on this funny new physics hypersurface. So technically, it's no different from putting a boundary condition at the Planck scale, as we've done for playing these games, but this is a different way of putting this into the mix. Question is, can we find some intelligent way of reverse engineering the formalism to see where this term like this might actually come in, or where it might destroy physics? And then, once you're able to do this, you can, of course, play the same game for predicting the initial state. And the question there is this regularity, as they call it, smallness of Moore's sign still predicts the state, and guess what is it? I have no idea, and like I said, this is an idea that just popped up.
What exactly do you want this thing to do for you? I mean, I know each mole has to wait until it gets the right
size. It's an implementation of mode creation in a very ad hoc manner.
Logically, it could replace the other, but what do you hope to gain from doing it?
Getting rid of high wave number vacuum modes that have no physical relevance. So this was what the first part of my talk was about: should we even try to formulate physics in a more consistent way as a boundary value problem on this new physics hypersurface, or should we just be completely happy with an initial value formulation that includes arbitrarily small length scales? Okay, I don't know. It's just a different way of creating these models. There's really nothing deep behind this so far. Well, that's it. That's all I wanted to say, and I'm offering offering the rest of my time to your colleagues.
Are there any questions?
Well, I would just say a comment for you. The thing is that you push your classical approach to normally where you should be pushing. And what you get out is all these fixes and this exotic business of the tunneling and all of that. So the question is, can one, the fan of pushing of the semi-classical approach into this inner zone to the extent that you do, or does space simply become chaotic and
sure,
granular?
But you see, the point is...
So this is, I'm not against it, but
yes.
You must be aware.
Oh, I'm absolutely aware, but it's the only framework we know. It's the only framework we know so far works on at low energies. And we might have observable consequences. So my question is, how far can we push this to make predictions that are testable? So at least we have a controllable mathematical framework for testing observations, for making some sort of predictions for signatures. Okay. So I'm not claiming that this is that if you go any further in this, that you end up having quantum gravity. Right? This is really a purely pragmatic point of view.
Maybe I can comment sometime on your last ideas, and since you spoke about it, you mentioned the work by the Cornell group, Henry Fai and Sasha Ritchie. So what they looked at is they went precisely beyond the mini superspace approximation in this.
Yes.
And what you find is precisely a radiation-like term.
Yes, I know, but with the other sign.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you can still do the whole analysis, and to answer your question, you don't get the there's no prediction for the initial state.
Okay. Unfortunately.
Because basically what happens is if you add the radiation component to the space-time, I mean the whole space-time evolution changes the sitter plus radiation. And the analytic continuation of the sitter, you know, is a sphere. And all these arguments here basically says that if you go to the analytic continuation, that your sphere is that the wave function smoothly matches at the North Pole.
For the Hardin-Hawking.
For the Hardin-Hawking field, yeah. So, but if you analytically continue to sitter plus radiation, you get a barrel. Basically, you take, you lop off your sphere. So there is, you know, yeah, whatever. There's no regularity constraint. There's no North Pole. There's no North Circle. There's no regularity.
Okay. So that answers one of my first questions. And that is, as soon as you drop symmetry, in this case, in the superspace, you end up having no clear.
Yeah.
And you don't even need to do this in a very strong way, only in a very mild way, because what they're doing is perturbative. Right?
Yeah.
So I think this is very unsettling for predicting observations. But okay, that's what makes this so interesting, because since we now claim to observe inflationary perturbations, which are consistent with being close to the symmetric ground state, that might tell us something about physics. Okay, well then, I don't know if there's anything else planned, since I don't know when the next workshop, Mr. Chairman.
So we'll have an extended topic.